listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Ewan Lowe.
And I'm Fran Barber.
And we are this week in Pentecost 5, the fifth week of Pentecost, as I understand it. And our readings are Amos, chapter 7, verses 7 to 17, Psalm 82, and Luke 10, verses 25 to 37. Well, those are the ones we're discussing anyway. Yeah. So let's begin with the Amos text, Amos chapter 7, verses 7 to 17. Fran, anything particularly intelligent you want to say about Amos?
Well, something about the figure himself. Mm-hmm. So, or first of all, about the book, that it appears towards right at the end of the Hebrew scriptures, but actually is one of the oldest books in it. Mm-hmm. Amos is considered a minor prophet, but that's not because what he said was any less significant than the so-called major ones, but just that it's shorter. Mm-hmm. And he lived in the 8th century. He was a shepherd, and he lived in Tekoa, which is about 10 miles from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So he's a southerner, and a lot of his prophecy, which is doesn't pull any punches, and is directed towards the northern kingdom, which was one of the reasons he, as we found in this passage today, his prophecy was rejected because he could go back home and criticise his own locale, Amaziah thinks. So the book's a selection of oracles that was probably compiled around the middle of the 6th century, mm-hmm. a couple of hundred years after he lived. So we've come to the famous passage today, famous as in I think we're all familiar with the plumb line, which appears in verse 7. Mm-hmm. I understand has an unusual translation, or the word is a very rare word, anak, which some people translate as tin, and I think there's some level of an ambiguity about what the word actually means. But I think it's clearly a metaphor for the crookedness of Israel and the people of God no longer line up.
Yeah, as with any sort of exegetical dilemma, right, you can spend ages and ages on it and not really end up getting anywhere and miss the forest for the trees.
Yeah, so we won't.
Yeah. But what's important is that there is a prophetic oracle and it stokes the ire, doesn't it?
Of the
others, the northerners, and he is, well, there's a bit of an exchange, and then he has some very stern words for those who would rebuke him as prophet.
Yeah, I mean, the words in verse 9 are actually incredible. 8 and 9 are really stern in the sense that I will never again pass them by. There's something really, it's already been decided. It's not, I won't part, you know, I will not.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's it. It's happened. The high places of Isaac shall be made desolate, so where all the other gods are worshipped, and the sanctuary of Israel shall be laid waste. This is a comprehensive clearing away of refuse.
Mm.
And just a quick point, really, sort of the rising up with the sword is that the threat of God's judgment for Amos is expressed in military terms.
Yes.
And he had in mind the Assyrians' threat to Israel.
Mm. And it's interesting to me that, you know, consistently I see when we come to different texts that this province of military violence, if you like, is so often the domain of God, or at least claimed by God, even though it's exercised by humans.
Mm. Problematic.
Mm, very problematic. But also, I guess you could sort of excuse it a little in that way by, you know, sort of ascribing it to God rather than to human forces, right?
Yeah,
sort of,
yeah.
Well, it wasn't me. It was God who told me to do this thing. But yeah.
So Amaziah's not very impressed with him at all.
No, distinctly unhappy.
So, I mean, I would describe Amaziah as an establishment priest. Would that be correct?
I mean, it looks like it. If we just take this, you know, text as it is, it looks like that is pretty much what's happening here. You know, there's a bit of a turf war almost, right? And you know, it's sort of like, what's this fella, what's this person come around, you know, trying to prophesy on my turf? Go back to where you came from.
Yeah.
We don't want your prophecies around here.
I mean, I'm really struck by these words. The land is not able to bear all his words. Yes. I mean, that there's a sermon title you could play with there with some, a collection of those words. The land is not able to bear all his words. So we get a real sense that this is truth speaking to power and questioning the luxury and the comfort of the people at the expense of the poor.
The other thing that's interesting as well, just very briefly, and this has nothing to do with how you might preach it really, but it's just interesting to note how Amaziah shortens or summarizes what Amos has said in verse 11. He's like, oh, well, Amos has said this, this, and this. You know, when we can read it quite literally, there's a lot more to say than that.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting little object lesson in how reporting back certain things by omission.
Or the sanitizing of the message.
That's right.
You know, and that's inflammatory in itself, but not in the way that Amos's main message is.
Mm. Well, and then so Amos reacts to that and his words get harder, really. Directed specifically at Amaziah, but my goodness, that's some judgment from in verse 17, isn't it?
Yes. That's the reversal or the consequences of Israel not heeding the word is destruction at every level of livelihood, identity, and purity.
Mm. And that little echo at the very end of that of what Amaziah's editorializing has said, right? Israel must go into exile away from his land, and then at the end, Amos almost repeats that back at him. Israel shall surely go into exile away from its land. But one of the things I noted looking through a couple of commentaries and in doing a little bit of research into the text was this idea that this judgment that Amos casts on Amaziah, you know, where it's not just Amaziah who's going to suffer as a result of what he says, but his whole family is going to suffer. Wow, that's really hard. And a couple of commenters were noting that, well, you know, it's helpful to remember that within the context of the time, within the worldview of the time, you know, there's this principle of familial solidarity, right, of kinship, where, you know, if one person suffers, we all suffer. Mm. Or if one person is judged, we are all judged because we all come from the same root or the same family. And we would find probably similar strains of thought, certainly, you know, for many of us who are diaspora people. And in speaking to some Aboriginal people, you know, they've got similar ideas about kinship and family groups. So that's something that I think could be a little bit difficult to navigate if you weren't aware of that context.
I understand as well from some of the reading I did that Amos is from a time where judgment as a collective thing was much more prevalent than later on. So Ezekiel sort of does do a bit more of the separating of the sins of the father, so to speak, from the sons. Whereas here, you know, I'm also struck by, this comprehensive prophecy of Amos, that this level of destruction, and there are poor amongst the people of Israel. Mm. Are they to suffer the fate of the rich in Israel? You know, they're going to be caught up. Their victimhood is already there in their poverty and they're being overlooked, etc. But then they also are caught up in God's judgment. So I think this passage, or Amos himself, really presents very significant pastoral theological problems or issues, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. But having said that, I do think that, you know, if we think through sort of how societies work, if you know, the rich already suffer the consequences of, sorry, the poor already suffer the consequences of the rich and the lifestyles of the rich anyway.
Mm.
No, so I don't think it's necessarily, from where I sit, an unfair thing in that sense that, you know, if society is judged by God, purely hypothetically, I think it's not an unfair comment in that sense because we're trying to work out how I explain this, but
well, they'll suffer that loss of livelihood and identity. Well, I suppose they have anyway because they're poor. Right. They're poor anyway.
That's right. And it's that whole idea, I guess, in a sense, that societies are judged by how the poor are treated, rather than how well the rich live.
Yeah. I mean, the other powerful theological reality that Amos lays bare for us is that God's graciousness and God's judgment aren't necessarily separate things. Mm. So, you know, we are very comfortable with judging one another, particularly if we don't know each other and we can do it on social media or we can, you know, we're fine with that sort of judgment. But the challenge here is to preach about God's judgment or preach it. Mm-hmm. There are consequences. This isn't just a passage about ethical right doing.
Yes.
You know, that's an easy thing to preach at one level. But what is this saying about who God is?
Yeah, and about, you know, the voice of God's messengers, which I find particularly challenging. You know, this idea that Amos is almost a bit like a whistleblower, right?
Yeah.
Someone who's coming along and saying, well, here's an issue and you need to take heed of this. But he is oppressed and pressed down as a result. And we've seen that multiple times in, unfortunately, you know, church organizations and denominations and things. And because of that, the judgment of God comes upon those institutions or, you know, people, those who institute this hushing up or this covering up of different prophetic voices.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the challenge here, although the word covenant doesn't appear in Amos at all, he is alluding, well, I think scholars have had lots of debate about this, but there is very, I think, clear allusion to the covenant with the particularity of the relationship between Israel and God that's depicted throughout these oracles and the fact that God will act differently because Israel of his relationship with Israel than he would with other nations doing the same thing. Mm. But you know, will God's covenant endure through this level of human sin is kind of the key question. And, yes, I mean, Amos does have an end in sight. You know, you might need to preach this having, you know, talking about what goes on in chapter 9.
That's right, looking towards the future.
Yeah. We might be time to move on to the psalm, which is obviously related. You got some things that really struck you in Psalm 82?
Psalm 82. In previous episodes, it always jumps out at me, and people will be aware of this by this point, but I'm always fascinated by this idea of the acknowledgement of other gods.
Yeah, that struck me as well.
It comes up time and time again. It's just, yeah, you know, and in this instance, the divine counsel, in the midst of the gods, he holds judgment.
Mm.
And it's this idea that Israel at this point in time doesn't seem to be shying away from this idea that, sure, on paper they're monotheistic,
but
it's probably a little bit more complicated than that, isn't it?
And it's perhaps not as big a leap as we think it is.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely fascinating because, you know, we have this tendency to think of them as very monolithically monotheistic.
Yeah, yeah, and it was much more complicated and nuanced than that. And, I mean, you and I had a quick exchange before we pressed record, Ewan, but, you know, I think about this and that if you travel to certain parts of the world, like Bali or Malaysia or many other places, the prevalence of other gods is clear to see, or the belief in other gods is clear to see. Mm. When you're a Westerner where this is, you know, when you live in a Western part of the world, the visceral reality of that is lost to us. So I think we lack an appreciation for the sort of imagery that is being evoked in this psalm, of what life is like.
Having said that, I do think that in the Western world, we do see many people or corporations or things as like unto the gods, right?
Indeed, and maybe they're more sinister because we don't use the term gods about them.
Mm.
We just attribute great worth to them without actually honestly admitting that they're false gods.
Well, that's right. And you know, these people or corporations or things have powers, you know, that shape the world. And you know, if that's not what semi-divine, I don't know what is. But that's where this psalm is actually a great encouragement, right? You know, I honed in, I mentioned to you, I honed in on verse 7 in particular. But this idea that, you know, all things pass. Sure, you know, at the moment, it looks like, you know, whichever person or thing or whatever is the god of our age, and that they dominate over all things, but they too shall die like mortals and fall like any prince.
Yeah.
And that ultimately, you know, following or worshipping these gods is a bit of a fool's errand because, you know, Yahweh in this instance is sovereign and remains sovereign.
For all the nations.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Not just Israel. So there is, I mean, this is a psalm of hope, great psalm of hope and good news then.
And the middle bit, you know, sort of verses three and four in particular, this call for justice over and over again, you know, such a strong theme that we've seen already, you know, well, in some of Amos's other words.
Yeah, yeah.
and in the text that we'll look at next as well, but this idea of justice flowing through, that Yahweh is interested in justice and that it's a foundational principle all the way through, you know, the thought of the biblical texts.
Yeah, the echoing and the chorus really of today's readings, all of them are actually on that tune.
Mm, absolutely.
Of justice to the poor.
Yeah. Was there anything else you wanted to say about Psalm 82?
No, I think we've covered most of what really struck me, but I would probably do a bit of reading around the notion of the divine council and the notion of the polytheism of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think Howard Wallace's lectionary information online, we can put a link in, he talks about how Israel was monolatrous, which is not a word I'd come up across before. It means worshipping only one god while allowing the possible or assumed existence of other gods.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think I might use this as an opportunity for preaching that that ultimate vision of God and God's promise and God's sovereignty, but also time to learn a bit about the Hebrew people. And
I suspect when you look into that, you might discover that the worldview of particularly some of our younger people today is not too different to that.
Ah.
You know, or at least certainly there'll be an acknowledgement of powers and principalities.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And small things in our day-to-day life, but also the corporations like you mentioned and the sort of fortitude we need from time to time to actually notice those contrary voices and critique them and resist them.
Yes.
You know, it gets back to that notion that we go to church to be put back together, having heard a whole lot of contrary visions of what is true and fulfilling, that this is to whom we belong, and this is the true sovereign.
That realignment.
Yeah. So the so-called Good Samaritan. Ewan, what possible new thing could we say about this?
Well, I've never heard a sermon about this.
No. So did you want to kick off?
Sure, yeah. You know, it can be difficult to try and reinvent the wheel, but I think both of us have pretty interesting takes and quite different ones on this text. So I'll do mine and you do yours.
Yeah.
So the one that I like, which has been posited a little by a couple of scholars, the majority of scholars aren't really in favor for a number of reasons, and I think they're pretty good exegetical reasons. But nevertheless, I think it's a way of capturing the imagination of those listening.
Which is what preaching is about. Yeah.
But the suggestion is that this man who's coming down is attacked and left for dead on the road. And for all intents and purposes, he appears dead or may as well be dead. So the priest and the Levite who pass him by, according to Levitical law, shouldn't really be touching him. Because by doing so, you know, the suggestion goes, they're actually making themselves ritually unclean and therefore unable to minister. Now, for a variety of reasons, that could be a little problematic because, you know, the direction that they're heading in and so on suggests that that's not the case. But having said that, it really captures my imagination because what then becomes, this story, is a story about us using our religious obligations to, well, essentially to avoid, you know, helping the poor and the needy, in a sense, or at least justifying our lack of action.
Right, so propping up an institution, perhaps, rather than engaging in community beyond the
And the really scary thing, I think, about it is that, you know, we've all been there, and you can easily make those justifications, right? I mean, I remember one of my friends was telling me a story of how he was on his way to preach one morning and he saw someone whose car had broken down.
Mm.
And it was that question of, oh, no, do I stop to help this person? Or you know, I've got a duty and a responsibility to these, you know, few hundred people that I'm going to preach to now.
Mm.
You know, how do I balance that? And I think this story gives a pretty comprehensive answer to that, if we read it in that way, with that question about, you know, purity and holiness. And, you know, it's a bit of the leave the 99 to chase after the one echo of that story
in
that sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, it may not be exegetically entirely correct, but to me it's one that it's a way of reading the text that captures the imagination and actually probably is more convicting for the clergy and the ministers than necessarily for the congregation. But it's an exciting way to read it, I think.
Yeah. So what I would want to avoid here is what are the readings of this, which have, in the words of Terry Eagleton, who's a literary critic from England, ends up with the godless gospel, which is this is just about a kindness in our hearts that's sort of latent there, and you know, Jesus just brings it out of it, and if we do the right thing, you know, it's all going to be fine.
Well, it's difficult because even the phrase has seeped into culture.
Yes,
hasn't
it has.
It? So you know, it's kind of lost a lot of potency, unfortunately.
So I was taken by a reading of this, a very old one by Origen.
Mm-hmm.
He did an allegorical reading of this parable, and there's some alarm bells for some people when they hear that word, but there's a creativity and a different vision that you get when you look at an interpretation like that, which I think does help. What we're talking about here is an emphasis in interpretation, aren't we?
Mm.
It's not that the moral imperative is not there.
Yeah.
But it's about how do we shift the emphasis to something where God is present for us and acting, and we're not the main actors, but God is.
That's right.
And that's what's being lost.
Realigning of our priorities.
So Origen, I mean, you can look this up in lots of places, but Origen saw that the man who was wounded and in the gutter was Adam, and the robbers were the sort of human enemies or devils, for want of a better word, that the priest represents the law, Mosaic law, and the Levite, the prophets, and so on. The Samaritan himself is actually Jesus, in Origen's understanding, and he goes into quite a bit of detail on with that interpretation that the animal that the man's put on is Christ's body and so on. And I would say one thing that is convincing about this reading, it just is in the use of the word he was moved with pity, which in Greek, can you say this better than me, Ewan?
I haven't got it in
Splagnitsomai.
Yeah, it's that bowel movement.
Okay, that means literally the bowels are moved, and it's only appears three other times in Luke's gospel, in the raising of the widow's son and the man among thieves. And the two sons and the forgiving father. And it's used of Jesus in all those ones. And here it occurs in the middle of the story of the Samaritan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, the Samaritan or Jesus was moved with pity. So that what comes out of this is that we are the ones on the road and Jesus comes to our aid. And because we are bound up as we are the wounded bound up by Jesus and saved, we can do so for others, so that it's not just about our ought, you know, that we ought to be doing this good deed, but that we are the receivers of it. We are the church of those who, well, of this Good Samaritan, but we're not a collection of Good Samaritans ourselves.
Mm.
That's not where the emphasis is.
No, that's right. We are responding out of the grace shown to us.
Yes.
Rather than being the graceful ones.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
That sense.
The other, so that's a bit of a riff on what I think there's some real preaching merit and power in that, in that take. I also would want to just talk a bit about the exchange with the lawyer.
Oh, yes.
But wanting to justify himself, which really is, if someone says, what does sin mean? Well, let's just those six words. that's what we do, you know.
Yes.
But it's this whole theological conversation where he's given an answer that, you know, what's the main commandments? And, you know, Jesus answers him. But then it's like, no, I just need a bit more detail just to know whether or not I need to really go as far as you're suggesting I need to go. You know, what's the small print? And that thing of who is my neighbour, and Jesus answers in such a way that the noun, and Brendan Byrne talks about this in his commentary in A Manner of Speaking, that the noun becomes a verb. He doesn't say, this is who your neighbour is. Go and be neighbourly is the answer to the lawyer's question. Mm-hmm. And it's just that whole phenomenon in theological conversation, which I find very creative and quite liberating, is that search for the precise detail or definition mm-hmm. isn't always the way to life.
Yes. Well that's a very that's a stern reminder for the academics among us, isn't it?
No, well, that's not what I didn't mean it like that. But
you're not wrong at the same time.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's the classic, you know, how many angels dance on a head of a pin sort of conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Where Jesus, in this instance, and many other instances, just cuts through all of that and refocuses the priorities of those who really should know better.
Yeah.
And that's us, unfortunately.
The other motif you could go through with this passage too, and you'd be taking in the wider context with the mission of the 70 before, mm-hmm. Who incidentally, part of their mission is to go and be neighbours. They go to people's houses and they eat and so on.
Yes.
But it's the motif of a journey. So there's a lot of geography mentioned here. I mean, in this passage itself, it's the whole world. Jerusalem to Jericho is really the whole of existence. And there are other places mentioned in the surrounding passages, none of which make literal geographical sense. So, you know, what is going on here is a spiritual or a theological journey that Jesus is taking all these actors on and reconfiguring for the lawyer a whole lot of things and also obviously for us.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's all I had to say about that. There's much ground that has been trod upon in speaking about the Good Samaritan, but I think we've had a couple of pretty interesting takes on it.
Yeah, yeah, and I would just say keep the focus on not us as the actors.
Yeah.
Gets back to that thing. Ben Myers' 10 rules about preaching parables is don't assume you know who each of them are, who all the characters are.
Yeah, no, I love that.
Thanks for listening.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.